and welcome to Showing Up with Good Culture. I'm Liz Matthews.
And I'm Jordan Mitchell.
Showing Up is a podcast with purpose where we speak to the change makers who are positively contributing to culture. In this episode, we are speaking to everyone's ultimate girl crush and Liz and I's new BF, Stacey Dooley.
Stacey is one of Britain's most admired documentary makers. She first appeared as contributor on the BBC Three series Blood, Sweat and T-shirts, a programme highlighting throwaway fashion. From 2009 to present day, Stacey has produced over 80 docs, reporting from some of the world's most hostile territories. Women, children, the marginalised and the exploited are at the heart of her storytelling, and they frequently end up in the most watched section on the BBC iPlayer. In 2018, just 10 years into her career, she was awarded an MBE for services to broadcasting. And later that year, she only bloody won Strictly. And we fell in love with her just that little bit more.
Her debut book, On the Frontline with Women Who Fight Back, draws on encounters with the brave, wonderful women Stacey has met over her career. And 2022 saw the release of her new book, Are You Really Okay? Understanding Britain's Mental Health Emergency. Inspired by Stacey's two most recent BBC documentaries on mental health. Following several sellout UK tours, An Evening with Stacey Dooley will return in 2022 alongside the publication of her latest book. Save us a couple of seats, will ya?
Girls, come
on. The front row.
Flipping it. Well, you've come a long way from handing out flyers at Luton Airport, babe.
Isn't it bonkers? I always feel a bit out of sort when I get an intro because I'm like, oh, I can't quite believe it. Isn't it mad? Life is just nuts. Nuts.
You've done so much and you're 35, you're a baby. Well, listen, thank you so much. You are literally our dream guest. Basically, when we did this podcast series, we just made all of our clients do it. And then we had a couple of spots and we were like, who do we really, really, really want to chat to? And then we asked you and you said yes. So it is a dream for us. The podcast is called Showing Up. And we start each episode asking our guests what that term means to them, because it means something different to everyone, I think. So what does showing up mean to you, Stacey Dooley?
Oh, it's quite a big question, isn't it? So you feel that there's a pressure to say something very earnest or very sort of profound. I suppose, essentially, I mean, it's up to interpretation, but for me, I guess it's about just presenting yourself and being unapologetically yourself. This is me, you know, this is where I'm from, this is what I'm thinking, and not feeling like you have to constantly justify your existence or presence. Do you know what I mean? And I think as well, you know, showing up for your pals, your family, your gang, people who have been there for you, you know, it's, yeah, I suppose that's my interpretation of it.
I think that's brilliant. So, Stacey, I've got a bit of a fun fact.
Go on.
And it's really random. And I wanted to tell you when we saw each other at the lovely Stylist Awards, but I thought I'd save it for the pod because basically, probably about 10 years ago when you did the Blood, Sweat and Tears show for BBC iPlayer, I was meant to be going on that show as well. So I had been jabbed up. I was ready to go. They were sorting out everything.
What the hell? Stop.
And I pulled out.
Yes.
And I pulled out, and I pulled out because I was so scared because the concept of the show was full on. Like, you would be literally out there in sweatshops. And I just
I freaked out. And this is a revelation.
I freaked out. So my question to you is, I thought I was quite a brave person, but clearly when it came to the crunch, I kind of wasn't. I didn't sort of back myself. But what made you jump on the plane and go and do a show like that, which is completely out of your comfort zone, really bloody bonkers and scary? What made you do it?
I actually, you've really surprised me. I had absolutely no idea. It would have been pals. Imagine.
Listen, we can catch up now.
Oh, Jordan, what a shame. But anyway, you're totally right. So the premise, I suppose, because this was like, what was this? This was nearly 15 years ago when I did Blood, Sweat. Because I was sort of 19, 20 and I'd just turned 35. So at the time, it felt really quite radical and quite progressive, even though the premise was relatively straightforward. It was the idea that they would take, you know, six consumers who were sort of really into disposable fashion, throwaway fashion, take us to India and show us sort of firsthand how our garments were produced. And sort of very quickly, we understood that we were complicit, actually. There was such a like this insatiable appetite for fast fashion. And we were buying T-shirts for a couple of quid or whatever. And we were almost celebrating it, weren't we? We'd be like, And I learned such a huge amount on that show. And thank God I did it. You know what I mean? Because like you say, you know, it can feel quite daunting when you're saying, oh, shit, it's going to be on the telly. Or when it's going to be quite full on. Oh, and it's going to be like legit. You're really going to immerse yourself, you know, in this situation. So yeah, delighted I did it, but I'm gutted you didn't do it.
You know what, but I think the thing is, and they do say you regret the things that you don't do, and I definitely think that of all the things that I've done in my life, that's the only thing I've regretted. But have you always been, you'll throw yourself into situations that are a bit unknown, and you've always sort of had that sort of, oh well, let's just feel the fear, do it anyway?
I suppose at the time, like I say, I was much, much younger and I didn't have a great deal going on, to be totally honest. I was working at Luton Airport. I would do 12-hour shifts. It was like 6 till 6. You'd never see any daylight. So when you're working in winter, you'd get there, it was dark. You'd leave, it was dark. You know, I didn't really have any ambitions in terms of establishing a career or anything like that. So this sort of opportunity came along. And it was very, the sort of top lines were, do you like fashion? Do you like travel? Do you like telly? And it was like, well, let me just, you know, give them a call. And you'll know firsthand all the conversations that you have with researchers, et cetera. And I think now I work in television, I understand they just must have been sort of rubbing their hands in glee because I was so unaware and my existence was, you know, Luton. So I imagine everything I was saying was soundbite, you know, television gold. But yeah, thousands applied. So yeah, I mean, it's testament to you that they wanted you to come because only 6 of us went in the end. What were your reservations? What do you think?
Well, to be honest, and obviously we'll have to have a cup of tea separately and talk about this, but I had a young baby at the time. So I was a teenage mum. I think that's what they sort of liked about it anyway, you know, being a teen mum, sort of, you know, kind of going away from my normal life to sort of experience this whole different thing. And my daughter was really sick. She was born prematurely, so she would get sick a lot. And I just freaked out. And I think that's when those limiting beliefs, when you kind of go, oh, but what if I bring back something and then it makes her sick and then she's in hospital over Christmas? So I remember it was filming over like winter. I feel like it was sort of like a December timeline and I was thinking, bloody hell, and I'm going to be sick, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, that's
perfectly understandable reason, actually.
So fast forward to this present day, you've made over 80 documentaries. I don't know how or where you found the time, but how do you choose your subjects? You must have such a good relationship with the Beeb now that you can go and say, I read this study, or do they come to you? Do you go to them? How do you choose the subjects that you dig into? What's that process like?
Yeah, so I think initially it was a lot more the Beeb would come to me and say, oh, you know, we've got this idea, or we'd like to, you know, have a look at this particular topic. Do you fancy fronting it? And I was very much a presenter, so I would turn up on location. I'd be sort of invested for 2 or 3 weeks and then I'd come back in the edit just to do the voiceover. And, you know, it was really the producers and the directors and the execs that were making the films. I think certainly the last 5 years or so, it's much more collaborative. So I will go to the Beeb and, you know, God, I find this really fascinating. Is it worth exploring this? Can I have some development money? You know, sometimes you're really passionate. You think, God, this is so necessary. This is so important. This is absolutely what we should be talking about. And it's a flat no. And you have to trust that actually the commissioners have been there a lot longer and actually sometimes they're right. You know, it's interesting to you, but, you know, not the kind of wider audience. But sometimes you have to dig your heels in. And that's happened a few times. Like years ago, it's a good example, I made a documentary that was in the Philippines and it was an incredibly dark subject. It was, I always end up talking about, you know, things that are quite shocking, but it was essentially about paedophilia. And I just really felt like I'd been to the Philippines before and I was making a film about something slightly different. And then this became apparent that it was like this kind of chronic problem in certain areas. Obviously, I don't want to kind of generalize, but, you know, and I came back and I said, look, I'm desperate to make a film about this. I think we should absolutely be investing in this. And as long as you've got sort of decent treatments and you've got reports and you've got contributors on the ground and, you know, researchers and fixers, then I think generally they trust me now and my gut instinct.
Must be really hard to sort of find an opportunity of a really dark subject matter, and natural instinct is, I don't want to go there. I don't want to understand this any deeper. But you almost feel, do you feel like you've got an obligation as a documentary maker to bring that visibility and share that with a wider audience so that something can be done about it? I mean, how do you sort of balance that feeling of, I don't want to know this, but also I feel, because, you know, sometimes I have to watch things to do with kids getting murdered, and as I've got five kids, and I have to force myself to watch things just so that I can get a full rounded appreciation of the world. So how does, you know, has there ever been anything where you've gone, this is a step too far?
I think you're right. I think when it's anything to do with children suffering, that just is gut-wrenching, and we're all human, you know what I mean? And the idea that the most vulnerable section of our society are taken advantage of, just, you're so angry, and you have to, what I've learned over the years, I'm still so far from perfect, but what I think I've evolved in terms of, I try and not be so reactive and so emotive. I sort of really have to put that to the one side and sort of try and be calm and coherent and try and listen to their warped justification, that the perpetrator, because I think if you only shout and bawl and kick off, you're never going to get any closer to trying to comprehend what's going on in their mind. And actually, hating someone doesn't keep kids any safer. So you need to try and be quite pragmatic. But sometimes it's really hard. You know, you just want to wrap your arms around the kids and do something else to, you know, the perpetrator. God,
it's big. It's big, big stuff. And we're so grateful that you use your platform and your voice and put yourself in those situations to tell those important stories. And I remember listening to an interview that you did where you talk about getting out of the car in Iraq and smelling death. And you describe this moment about having to avoid walking across unexploded IEDs. And instead, you have to walk across two dead bodies. I mean, like, just take a minute to think about what, you know, that is heavy. Firstly, have you ever been in a situation where you thought, oh shit, like, I might not get out here because I might step on one of these things?
And when I describe those situations, I never say it because I want to sort of, you know, sound gratuitous or like over exaggerate. No. But I just think it's really important for people to understand what war looks like, you know. Yes. it's so devastating. Just to give you an example, when I've been to Iraq 3 times, right? And one time I went, Mosul, which is the second largest city, it was, IS was still in control of that area. And when I returned, it had been liberated. Mosul had been liberated. I cannot tell you. I mean, I suppose our second largest city is Birmingham, right? So imagine driving through Birmingham and everything is completely obliterated. There's no, everything has been smashed to pieces. There are no roads. There are very few buildings still standing. People have had to flee their homes. They don't know where their kids are. They, you know, they've lost their grandparents, ex-wife. It's just the most abhorrent of situations. And so when I went back there, I feel so frightened, Jordan. I can't pretend I'm brave. You know what I mean? There's no part of me that's sort of swaggering about. I'm terrified. And but then I remind myself, like, I'm often with these really remarkable women, and this has been their life for years and years and years. I'm there for 2 weeks. So if I can just hold it down for 2 weeks, I can give them a platform that arguably they wouldn't have otherwise, and just for them to tell us what their lives have been like. But I'm, you know, I'm nervous, I'm sweating, I'm clammy, I feel sick, you know, I feel really frightened a lot of the time, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
2 weeks. I'm like, bloody hell, it's all 2 days. I'm like, get her out of there.
You sort of have this conversation in your mind where you think, well, Stacey, you fought for this commission. You voluntarily got yourself on the plane. So there's no use moaning now. Like, you just got to do it.
You just got to ride it.
You must have such incredible trust in the people that you work with. I mean, me and Alexa went to Africa with Oxfam, and there were 3 choices of where we would go. And they send people out ahead of time and they suss it all out. And it's still not without risk or danger, but they kind of, you know, they path the way so that you're as safe as you can be. But I think documentaries as a genre are, you know, they can be quite inaccessible for many because they can feel quite serious, right? They can feel, I've got a 16-year-old, and if you say documentary, it's suddenly, it feels like heavy, it feels like homework. I feel like what you do is you democratize it for a younger audience, and you are educating people in such a brilliantly accessible way about heavy, heavy stuff. But what you are exposed to and what you see, must a little bit of that must stay with you. What? How do you not take too much of that on? We asked actually a similar question to Fern, because she interviews quite a lot of people with, you know, The Happy Place. And, you know, I'm just interested to know how you take a bit of that and, you know, and leave some of it at home so you can just go and have a normal life at home and hang with your mates and it not be too heavy.
I think, yeah, it's a really valid question because, you know, when you're on location, when you're filming, everything else goes on the back burner. You are sort of so desperate to do the story and the contributors justice, because also you sort of don't take it for granted that they're going to open up and give you access. So the idea that they've said, actually, come and follow me for a couple of weeks, let me talk you through what my life looks like. I think, right, okay, I'm here, I'm with you, let's go. And you're right, sometimes when you come home, it sort of takes a couple of days to readjust, or you can very quickly forget how difficult life is for so many other people. When, I can't lie, I now sort of move in a quite a middle-class crowd. Mm-hmm. And I always have to have a word to myself, Stacey, you know, celebrate the small victories, make sure you know how fucking lucky you are, never ever ever take it for granted. And I think, you know, I've never had therapy, but there's, you know, I would never shy away from it if I felt like it was beneficial, and I've been offered it a couple of times, you know, and the people are good like that, that's not me paying lip service. They'll say, you know, if I've done something particularly intense, they'll say, you know, here's the phone number if you want to have a conversation. We don't even have to know, you know, don't worry about, you know, us sort of being privy to conversations that you might have. So I definitely would if I felt like I needed it in the future. And I think as well, I really lean into escapism. And I think as well, some people don't really understand my style of journalism or my approach. I think sometimes they think you can't be multifaceted. You have to be totally objective, totally neutral, totally, you know, very sort of lofty, highbrow, recognisable journalism. For me, it's like, I really give a shit about what's going on in the world. But equally, I love dancing and I love, you know, matches. And I love, do you know what I mean? I love going down the can and talking nonsense. I listen to the mix in the kitchen, you know what I mean? And I don't have to justify whether or not I am a serious journalist or, you know, a presenter that does shows about glow up, you know, that was a makeup
totally joke. Well, we don't exist in a silo, and I love that. One of the questions I did want to ask, and it is kind of in relation to the sort of documentary work, was really, is it hard knowing the true underbelly of the world? Like, when you're seeing people just happily walking down the road, do you ever go, if only you knew what I know? And, you know, because you've been there and you've almost lived like 100 lives because of the sort of the work that you do. And so, firstly, is it hard knowing the underbelly? But also, is there anything that you wish you could unhear or unlearn? Was there like one thing where you're like, oh, I really just don't need this in my head?
Do you know, this is a really good question, Jordan, because I think certainly the last month, lots of us who don't necessarily work in documentaries have been forced to recognise that there's this heartbreaking war playing out in Ukraine, and everyone is quite rightly outraged and they cannot believe how unfair this feels. And I've been feeling like that about other wars for the past 10 years. So I would come back, you know, you land in Heathrow and you've just witnessed devastation for the past 2 weeks, and then you're walking through duty free and da 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 da, and it's all just feeling very sort of trivial, everything's feeling quite sort of frivolous. And then you have to make sure that you don't end up being, did you know this and did you know that? Because they don't actually. And it's, you know, that's not their fault. But so it's you have to make sure that you don't get on your high horse. You can be passionate and you can want better, but you can't give people a hard time because they haven't witnessed or experienced what you have. And I think, yeah, like lots of people over the last month have been saying, you know, how can you post about this? Or how can you, you know, talk about clothes? Or how, you know, there's a war going on. And I'm like, you're absolutely right. But there have been moments where I've felt like that for a really long time. I'm like, this is nonsense. Why are we focusing on nonsense? And I suppose when I became a tiny bit more public facing after sort of 2018, there was this desire to know the ins and outs of who I was dating and just nonsense. And I was just thinking, but I've been, you know, talking about Yemen, for example, for you know, however long. So it's a good question. Sometimes you do feel a bit like, oh, fuck it. You know, if only.
Yeah.
But equally, you know, you can't give people a hard time for wanting to enjoy their lives and celebrate their happiness and joy.
I want to ask a question about your book, Are You Really Okay? So we, Jordan and I, mm-hmm. always work with a number of charities. We're called Good Culture. That is, it's a behaviour as well as a company name. And Movember is one of our clients and has been for the last couple of years. And so we know a lot about mental health, especially male mental health. Mm-hmm. We've both got sons. It's really, really important work for us. And I just sort of wondered what made you write that book? What made you want to explore mental health, particularly in young people?
I had made a couple of documentaries in a mental health hospital in South London. And, you know, prior to starting research for the first documentary we did, I can't say that I knew a huge amount about the landscape of mental health, sort of, certainly in the UK. And I suppose the idea was we wanted to go into this hospital and speak to people as people, not as people who were poorly or, you know, people that were being held under certain sections. We wanted them to just articulate and to describe to us what they were going through. And it's such a delicate issue. Obviously, you have to film it in a very sensitive way. And it was a different style, I suppose. So typically, if you're making a documentary, you sort of need written consent and verbal consent. When you're making a film about mental health, you know, their health is fluctuating, right? That's why they're in hospital. So we adopted something called rolling consent, which essentially means we sort of check in every day, every few days. Do you still feel like you want to contribute? Is this something that you think will be beneficial? And there was an instance where we sort of invested a lot of time in a really brilliant woman who was unwell. And she was so relatable. And that's what I loved about her, because, I won't sort of give too many details away, but she just felt like one of my pals. And we filmed for weeks and weeks and weeks. We met her mum, we met a doctor, we met a cousin. And then at the end, she says, Stacey, do you know what? I don't want to participate anymore. And that is fine. Of course, you think, oh, God, you are so remarkable and you've got so much to offer. But actually, you've got to be able to respect the fact that it's not for her. So then the process starts again. So I do believe, because, you know, there are legit questions, you know, is it responsible to film in a mental health hospital? That was the question I was asking the production company that I was working with. How are we going to do this ethically and responsibly? And ultimately, I believe, you know, you shouldn't shy away from topics just because they're more difficult. You just got to make sure you're treating people correctly. So, yeah, the films were really well received. And actually, I was doing a book tour about the first book, and we were in the Barbican, right? So that, I think that holds about 2,000 people. And this young girl put her hand up. It was like a Q&A at the end. A young girl put her hand up and said, Stacey, I watched your, and she was sort of quite unassuming. She said, oh, I watched your film about mental health, and just want to say that I've just left that particular hospital. And actually, I'm in an entirely different space now. Recovery is rarely linear, but it's absolutely possible. Thank you so, so much. Just, you know, and the whole of the Barbican were you know, just so on her side, so rooting for her. I just, the hairs on the back of my neck just stood up. I just thought, and this is why, again, I don't want to sound too sort of Miss World, but this is why you make documentaries, because you want to talk.
Yeah.
Everybody deserves to be represented. We all pay our TV license, no matter where you're from, who you are, where you live, your address, we all deserve to be seen. Anyway, that's why I made the book. That's what, you know, because there were lots of people that they didn't end up in the film. So yeah, we sort of did a bit more research and put the book together.
It's so brilliant. And I think your contribution to society and culture is like so, so significant that actually even just speaking to you now, I'm like overwhelmed by how much you show up. Honestly, I am. I just think you're remarkable. Like, not to actually just like fully, you know, fangirl in front of you, but honestly, what you're doing is so important. But on some of the lighter stuff, because I do feel like it's all about the balance.
Moving on to your new haircut.
Moving on to it. Well, listen, we had a fun fact from our producer, Charlie, who said that your box colour was the best selling in your range, which I just think that is incredible. How do you feel about that?
So low. Well, it's the best selling red they've ever had, which is just so jokes, isn't it? The daft thing is, right, Jo, look at the state of me now. I've got a hoodie on that I've had on for days. I'm so not glamorous. And it's just when they sort of approach you, I'm like, oh, you know, do you fancy some kind of working relationship? And it felt genuine, you know. I think I've been offered, I'm sure, you know, like everyone, I've been offered so many sort of deals and partnerships. And I think unless I really use it or rate it, then I'm tempted to shy away from it. So it felt like a legit partnership. But yeah, jokes, I know. And it breaks my heart, because when people come on tour, you want to see the girls that come. They've got bright orange hair, they've got big gold
hair,
and they've got, like, you know, oversized loungewear. And I just, honest to God, I just want to snog them all. I just want to grab them. I just think, oh,
so obviously, there's not a day that goes by when I'm not messaging you, DMing, being like, where's that dress from? The dress you had on for your birthday. But, like, I'm here for it. But talk to me about the chop, because we want to hear about this.
So this was, it was quite spontaneous, actually. So my hair was doing my head in, and I had been sat in an edit, so I'm much more involved now. So I was sat in the edit, and my hair, I just felt like I looked like an old witch. It just really wasn't working. It weren't a vibe. I was like, I've got to fucking sort myself out. I was like, what can I do to make myself look less like a witch? And I thought, I think the hair's got to go. You know what I mean? I've had the long hair for years. I thought, let me just switch it up. So I messaged my hairdresser. He's such a sweetheart. I was like, I'm thinking about taking it all off. He's like, are you really? I said, no, let's do it. And it was quite spontaneous. I sort of didn't really, you know, sometimes people think about it for weeks. Thank God I love it, because it was, as it was coming up, as it was falling on the floor, I was thinking, fuck, it's quite a lot. But then I really feel the part now. I'm loving it.
Yeah. Oh, and it's summer coming up. Honestly, I always do that every summer, don't I? I'm boom.
Yeah,
and it is always like on a shoot in the back room. Like, and then I just go home with different hair. And I was like, what the fuck?
Well, I want it to look like it's been hacked. You know,
it's a good hacking. It's like done with a razor.
You just watch. There's going to be all manner of bobs everywhere now. So talk to us about fashion. You love your fashion, don't you?
I do.
What is your like go-to designer if you just had to wear one thing? You can have like one high street and one designer if you like.
I tend to buy pieces that I'm going to love for a really long time. But I do think fast fashion is, for me, my personal opinion, is just a bit naff, the idea that you wear something once and then you throw it away. I can't subscribe to that. And I think actually it's so damaging to the planet now. It feels a bit icky. So I try and buy stuff that I'm going to love for a couple of years at least. I really like Ray at the minute. R-A-E-Y.
Oh my God, I love Ray. Yeah, matches.
And she's a sweetheart as well. So I've been back and forth with her a couple of times. And I just wear the stuff all the time. And it's like,
so good.
My dry cleaner, Love Is Art, it's always the same four grey sweatshirts. You know what I mean? I'm like, this guy must be so underwhelmed. Poor man. Nothing exciting, nothing remotely exciting coming through the door.
Well, you've presented a lot of entertainment shows such as The Glow Up, This Is My House, Daisy Dooley Sleepover, and of course, Secret from the Square. And then, of course, Strictly, which you won like a boss. Is it important to you to have a balance in the shows that you do and the work that you do?
Absolutely. And I think now more than ever, I just take on gigs that I want to do, because I think at the start, you're so mindful that people are going to judge what you say yes and what you say no to. But now, you know, I'm 35. I don't have to kind of worry about what outsiders are thinking or saying. So I suppose at the minute, I am working on two very, very different films. I'm working on a documentary with Mina Smallman. I don't know if you know that lady. She has been in the news certainly over the last year, but both her daughters were murdered in a park.
Oh, God, I know about the stories about the daughters, yeah.
Bieber and Nikki, Nicole. And she's so bloody brilliant, Mina. I can't begin to tell you. We've been filming together for over a year now. She got in touch with me, actually, and said, Stacey, you know, I've been asked to make a documentary, and I've said that I'm only going to make a documentary if it's with you. So, yeah, I totally appreciate, you know, there's a huge responsibility there on my part. But we've become pals. She's a real diamond. I really rate and love Mina. And, yeah, it's sort of well documented that the Met Police, there were two officers that behaved really despicably and they got custodial sentences. So we've been following Mina and her husband, Chris, and just making sure that the girls are at the centre of the film. So that is obviously a very serious documentary that needs to be prioritised. And also, on the other end of the spectrum, I'm making a film through my own little company, actually, about something much lighter, and that's going through entertainment. But yeah, it's an entirely different film, and it's sort of jazz hands and all that kind of vibe. So, and I think that's quite nice. You know, I get to hang out with Mina and have really necessary conversations, and then I'm talking to somebody else about not very serious.
I love that, because when we first started out as publicists, mm-hmm. everybody, you were told to pick a lane. Like mm-hmm. the people that we represented, it's like, you are a model, that's you, or you're a TV presenter, mm-hmm. or you're an actor. Like, God forbid you had another skill that you could offer the world and you were a photographer and a model, or an editor and an actor. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of, you're the definition of a polymath. And mm-hmm. I think that is so attractive. And I know you're, you know, you didn't have a traditional education, you didn't get loads of qualifications, and you've been educated, I don't want to say in the university of life, but, you know, traditional education is not a path for everybody. And I think you're a luminous example of that.
Yeah.
What I really want to know is, when are you going to do a chat show? In the US, there are so many brilliant women who are like the protagonists of the biggest chat shows in the world. And we've got a lot of American clients. We know the Ellens. We know all of those people. Mm. In the UK, I feel like, you know, it's like Jonathan and Graham, who are brilliant. But when's the Stacey Dooley chat show coming? Come on.
I mean, listen, you never know, do you? Stranger things have happened. I just love hanging out with people that I wouldn't normally get to hang out with. Like, and then that's really what the documentary is about. So a chat show would be ideal. I actually think it's really healthy and really important to hang out with people that sometimes you fundamentally disagree with. And
yeah,
a chat show perhaps would lend itself to that without being sort of too outrageous or unnecessarily sort of bombastic. You know, I like sitting down with people and saying, look, tell me what you think about this and why you think that. I think that's really useful. Actually, I'll do a series called Sleeps Over, which is not miles away from that. So we find a family in the UK and we arrive there on the Friday and we leave on the Monday. And sometimes there's real rub. You know, sometimes they stand for things that I just can't get on board with, and vice versa.
Oh my God, what about the trad wife?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Perfect
what
example.
Can you explain to the listeners what a trad wife is? It's literally the opposite of me and George.
I was just left scratching my head, you know. So, yeah, it's a really good example. A traditional wife. So they sort of like the idea of the woman being sort of subservient and, you know, it's the male that should be the dominant one and he sort of rules the roost and essentially whatever he says sort of goes. And obviously that sort of just feels so, I just want to rebel whenever I hear that kind of
dominance. It's so bizarre. I watched one where this woman was like, you were helping her make the dinner, and because you were like gassing away, the dinner was a little bit late, and she was genuinely, you were sort of saying, do you think he'll mind? And her response was, well, look, you know, it's fine this time, but I probably don't want to be late with this dinner again.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell?
That's what I'm saying. For me to sort of walk into their world, it would be really obvious. And actually, I think a lazy kind of approach to go in there and go, this is mad, you're an idiot, this is, you know, because then you're no closer to
understanding
from her point of view. So
yeah.
Just calmly, rationally have a conversation and say, look, I feel like this, but I can understand that you are coming from a different perspective. I just think that's really grown up.
It is. You must be brilliant in arguments, I have to say, because like,
honestly, I feel like Darren, my husband, needs you to move in, because this kind of like being able to take a step back. I hear you, but
not when I'm hormonal, Jordan. Not when I'm hormonal.
it's a different thing.
I want to play a fantasy game now. So it's a bit like that thing where you go, who would you have round for dinner? So you've got your primetime chat show, and you've got three spaces on that sofa. Who would you, and it's got to be people in the public eye, would you pick?
The three women that I am really feeling at the moment, Lise, the correspondent, the news correspondent for The Beeb, she's over in Ukraine at the minute, actually. I think she's Canadian. Her accent is quite unique. Do you know who I mean, Lise?
Yes.
I think she's doing such a sterling job, and I really admire her. My one true love is Orla Gurin. So she has been, you know, reporting from the front line for, it feels like, the last 100 years. I mean, she's just such a veteran. She is so established. I really, really like her. And you know who my new crush is? Andy Oliver.
Oh my God. That's it. That's it. She sold the...
Well, she is actually a friend of ours, and she is... joy personified. She did we worked on a Disney campaign all about the power of friendship. Makita with Miss Anne Harriman, and we asked Makita and Andy to do it. And we were in floods that their story of friendship between mother and daughter is
beautiful.
Next level. We were in absolute bits.
That is a great lineup.
She is
Andy, joking. I think she's such a mood, and I think she's got it totally right. She's got the balance totally right. She talks about really important things. You know, she talks about race, she talks about misogyny, she talks about class, but also I just cannot with her. The glasses are always so perfectly placed with the chain. I'm like, Andy, do you mind?
We need to get her on the pod. We definitely do.
I'd love to hear that.
So one of the last questions before we go on to our questions from our community is, of all your achievements today, what are you most proud of, and what else would you like to go out and conquer?
I'm most proud of. I find it really humbling when people who don't necessarily watch Dispatches or Panorama or listen to Radio 4 religiously come up to me and say, God, Stacey, do you know, I watched that documentary you did the other night, and I had no idea that, you know, gay conversion therapy was an issue in LA, and now I do. Mm. Because sometimes our documentaries focus on stories that aren't always sort of in the mainstream.
Yeah,
media.
They're quite niche.
We did a really beautiful film, well, a really important film about the Yazidi community. And so few people have heard about what the Yazidi community have been through. So when you get people, and especially like, you know, you could have a little school kid, you know, getting off the bus and saying, oh, Stacey, you know, Stacey, I saw that documentary. And you're so touched, because you think, as if this like 14-year-old who obviously doesn't watch the news is now talking about things that are going on in totally different parts of the world. That always gives me a bit of a boost. And then from a very sort of narcissistic point of view, there was a real career highlight for me when years ago we were at the NTAs, right? And David Dimbleby, who I have loved for however many years, he was picking up like a Lifetime Achievement Award or whatever. And he was about to deliver this speech. And in the speech, right, we're all sat in the O2. And in the speech, he's basically saying, tonight has been a real sort of highlight for me. I actually got to meet Stacey Dooley.
Oh, no.
I swear to God, it was. He said, you know, maybe some of you guys know her, you know, for her dancing, but I watch her documentaries religiously. And then I met him afterwards around the back, and I just, you know, when you're sort of trying not to, you know, try not to blush. And
stick a fork in me. Honestly, wow. God. That's amazing.
And I sort of always dine out on that. Yeah.
That's a moment. We've got some questions from our community.
Yeah, so we stole this idea from Amanda Decadene, who's one of our friends. The first question, and this is so random.
Fine.
This is like Ronnie Random. Somebody said, I heard your real name is actually Anastasia. Why did you change it to Stacey? Is that true?
Anastasia is my posh name. Well, I think my mum was sort of having a bit of a moment. So it's well documented. I sort of speak about it in the book. Our beginnings were quite humble. You know, I lived
there. Yeah, as are I. Yeah. We're talking to the humble working class humble massive.
But, you know, I sort of grew up, you know, we had a little bedsit above the pet shop and da-da-da-da-da-da. So I'm obviously a Stacey, right? And my sister, she's Livy, but, you know, her name is Olivia. And Stacey, short for Anastasia. I think my mum's just in denial. She was just sort of, thinking, if I give them these fancy names.
Posh names.
Yeah, maybe they'll somehow not be as rough as they are. But, I think I'm a Stacey than Anastasia.
You are totally a Stacey.
Can you imagine calling me Elizabeth?
Yeah, that's what Liz is, Elizabeth. I can't even believe it. No, couldn't bear.
Okay, so Claire wants to know, how have you counteracted negative words or thoughts that people have written about you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, and there's been hundreds. You know, there are some people that just don't understand why I am on the telly. And I think years ago, it really hurt and I really cared. And I just wanted to kind of put my point of view across. But I think the older you get, you become more assured. And that doesn't mean that you're not open to criticism. You know, we're all a work in progress and we get things right and we get things wrong. But I think as long as you know who you are and what you want to be, I think that's what you have to focus on. And the people that have met you, you can't place too much importance on what Barbara from Southend thinks of you because you've never met her. And actually, she's entitled to not like you. She's absolutely entitled to think you're an idiot. But if I've hung out with people and spent time with people, I feel a bit more gutted if they think I'm an idiot. So I just, I try and not pay it too much attention, but I do listen when it's constructive criticism and, you know, I need to be learning. So it's a fine balance, isn't it? It's really hard. It's hard.
No, it is. But also just ignore the haters. So just let them just hate in the corner. So this is a really good question, actually. What has been the greatest thing you've taken from your psych ward documentary? Your biggest learning?
I suppose it really, you know, mental health can really affect any of us. I don't think there are any of us that can say categorically that we'll never go through things or, you know, we'll never have those moments where we feel it's completely overwhelming or completely consumed by negative feelings. And that's what I think, when we were in that hospital, we met so many people and it was like so many of the lads reminded me of my cousins and, you know, so many of the girls, like I said earlier, I went about with them at school. It was like, it felt so familiar, even though you sort of have this idea in your mind that it's quite a sanitized, sort of sterile room. Actually, it's not. You're hanging out with people that you grew up with. Yeah, none of us are exempt would be the top line for me.
That's a strong takeaway.
Yeah.
So we start every episode with the same question, but we also end every episode with the same question too. And we ask, what can we all do to show up as individuals, kind of on a day-to-day, if you were to give us any advice, how could we show up?
I suppose it's just about talking about things that you feel strongly about, but also being willing to listen. I think sometimes, like particularly now, it can feel like we're so tribal and it's sometimes about winning the argument, not contributing to the conversation. And I think showing up is being willing to say, you know, I got this right, I got this so wrong, but we move, like let's all move forward collectively. Yeah, I wonder if that's what's showing up. That's what we can all do. But listen, don't ask me.
That is a brilliant takeaway.
I'm rambling
do this, but don't ask
everyone.
Me.
We're trying to figure it out, the same as all of us, yeah.
Oh, Stacey, it has been such a lovely way to spend a morning.
Oh my God,
thank
best.
You. And have a lovely day and we'll see you soon.
See you soon. Bye, girls.
Well, I don't really know what to say. Stacey bloody Dooley said yes to coming on our podcast. I mean, this is a dream guest for us. And I have been such huge fans. And like, you know, yes, from the style, the taste making, that we want the nail varnish, we want the bob, we want all of that. But really more the career, genuinely the career, because I've learned so much through her documentaries. I think she is. So I was watching a documentary, the one about living in a convent last night with Al and the twins as research. And Al had never seen, he obviously knew who she was, but he had never seen her present. And he won't mind me saying, he was moved to tears at the subject matter, but also just at the way he was like, she's so fucking likable.
Well, she's got
so relatable.
Much, she's got so much empathy and I think integrity, which is what we really learnt today. But God, I mean, I've got so many takeaways. One of mine is just, yeah, just such resilience to put herself in those incredibly challenging situations in the name of storytelling. And I just think it's really remarkable and generous. And if it wasn't for people like Stacey, then, you know, so many stories wouldn't be told.
And I'm really grateful that having kids of all different ages, I can watch something educational and interesting with 9-year-old twins and with a, you know, tricky 16-year-old son because of the way she tells the story. That subject matter, if it was told by someone a bit more earnest and a bit more traditional, just wouldn't land. And so I honestly think what she does, you know, is... it's really important. And I love the anecdote of the 14-year-old boy jumping off the bus being like, oh, Stace, I watched a documentary. That, I mean, and I love that that's her highlight. She could have said Winning Strictly, which obviously is really, I'm sure is a highlight. But what matters to her is the work she does, getting a chance to represent those stories properly. I think she's fucking ace. And I cannot wait to introduce her to Andy because this is going to be the start of something really beautiful.
It is. Oh, well, yeah. Thank you guys for listening. This is our last episode of the series, guys.
Can you actually believe it? We made 8 podcasts.
We've made
and
8 podcasts.
Do you know what? We've had such an amazing time. I think we are going to go again.
We've
got a list and it does include men this time. But I think I said this last time, if there is anybody that you think we should chat to, because now we've exhausted all of our clients, so we can't...
We've got a couple more to go through.
We have got a couple more clients, but we're going to open this out. We're going to open this out. So if there's anybody that you think we should speak to, let us know in the ways that you can let us know.
How do they let us know?
I think we'll put something on the show notes where they can email. We don't really know about the tech stuff.
DM us.
Neither did Stacey Dooley. We both had trouble setting up this morning and then I poured water all over the studio. So on that note, thank you so much for listening to Showing Up With Good Culture. We'll be back soon.
We'll be back. Bye, guys.
Bye.